everybody. Welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. Hope you're doing well. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. It's great to be with you as always. And also, I'm excited to be here with today's guest, Mr. Jack Carr. How you doing, sir?
What's up, man? How's it going?
Good, good. I got to ask, is that a real background or are you...
This is the real background. This is the where I'm supposed to do most of my writing in here. This is the nonfiction side, except for Ian Fleming and some of mine over here. And then the other room is all the fiction where I'm like collecting all the paperbacks I've read as a kid. I'm collecting those now as first edition hardcover signed in there, keeping my old paperback that I kept, but all those books that I read growing up, you know, now getting them in the hardcover that I didn't have back then. So
that's cool, man.
Yeah.
Okay, did you read The Hatchet?
Oh yeah. Hatchet,
Okay.
yep.
What about The Sign of the Beaver? You ever heard of that one?
Yeah, I haven't thought about that in a long time, but yeah.
That one sticks out as like my favorite for some reason. Anyway,
Yeah,
random.
I bought it for the kids, and I don't know if they ever read it. I don't remember reading that to them, but it's on the shelf downstairs in the kind of the young adult children section.
Cool. Cool, man. Well, that's cool. So that is this your home office or?
Yeah, this is where I'm supposed to do the writing up here, and then all the business stuff is supposed to be in the other room, but there's been so much going on. Oh, it's just full of boxes still for the last 2 years, so I haven't had a chance to really move in over there yet. But the idea was this is more like quiet, contemplative, reading, writing, and the other side is for all the chaos. But I can't even get through the initial chaos, physical chaos, to get things set up in there. So it's work in progress, work in progress.
Nice. So are you based in Montana? Is that right?
This is Park City, Utah.
Utah. Okay. Cool, man. Great. It's a beautiful state. One of
Not
the most
bad.
beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I'd love to hear, like I said before we started recording off air, I watched The Terminal List, to be
Okay.
honest. And then I hope this doesn't offend you as an author, but usually consume most of my books in audiobook format.
No, that's all good.
and you guys did a really good job producing the audiobooks. And so I am through True Believer, Savage Son, and I'm halfway through The Devil's Hand.
Nice.
Yeah,
I
I've just
like
been
it.
ripping through them, dude. They're
Thank you.
awesome.
Yeah, Ray Porter is amazing. That first book was up for audiobook of the year because of Ray Porter, the narrator. And
Well, author has something to do with it too.
well, I mean, yeah, it's a good partnership. And we've become dear friends over the years. And yeah, he did the first nonfiction as well, targeted here. I asked him if he'd do that, and he was super excited. He actually texted me and said, he's like, dang it, you made me cry in this one. Because it is emotional. It was emotional to write. It was emotional to interview these guys that went through what they went through back in October of 1983. It's emotional for me to talk about it in interviews, actually. But Ray just crushes it in all he does with the narration. He's a former a Shakespearean trained actor, and he's just and an awesome dude. Awesome. So he's done all those. My favorite one, people always ask me my favorite book, and it's still Red Sky Morning on the thriller side. I mean, it's the latest one, so it's always been the latest one that I've done because I think I'm getting better each time. That's always my goal, is to get better, even if it's just by a little bit, and also move the genre forward, even if it's just by a tiny bit. And so that's Red Sky Morning, the one that came out in June on the thriller side. That's been, and I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's hands down the best of all of them from
Okay.
a
And
narrator.
when you said that, I remembered I actually did it backwards. So I watched Terminal List and then I got Red Sky Morning when I
Nice.
found out we were doing this interview. And so actually that was the first one I listened to.
Oh,
And
nice.
because I was like, oh, yeah, I listened to it. You know, I'm going to interview. And then I was like, this is really good. I'm going to listen to all of them.
Oh, man. Thank you.
So I started from the beginning, but I did listen to Red Sky Morning first. And yeah, that one is wild.
Yeah, I think it's a richer reading experience if you start with the first one. Like the publishers always want you to say, you know, they're all standalone. You can pick up anyone because they want people to buy the latest. And I hear authors say that all the time, but I just can't say it. You know, it feels just disingenuous if you try it. For me, I would never say it. You can certainly, but I think it's a richer reading experience to start from the beginning because these characters are all on journeys, just like everybody else is in the world. We're all on a journey. And so he's the main character in particular is evolving and learning and from taking past experiences and past lessons learned and applying them, you know, going forward his wisdom. And so he's on this journey. So I think it's a richer reading experience if you start from the beginning, but you can jump in anywhere you want.
For sure. You do a good job of giving kind of enough background to where like you know what's going on, even if you just jumped in like to Red Sky Morning. But
That's the hard part. You don't want to do a copy paste type thing, which people talk about seeing sometimes in books. And so I'm very aware of that. So I try to figure out creative ways. Like if you're into Devil's Hand, the way I did it there was with a polygraph in the beginning. Main character is hooked up to a polygraph, getting asked questions, and then
Yes.
fills in the audience. If someone just started with that book, then it kind of brings them up to speed. And same thing, if you've even read the other ones and it's been a year, then it also brings you back up to speed. So I try to get creative with how I go about filling in the background. And that's kind of fun to figure out different ways to
Yeah.
do it each time.
For sure, man. I was gonna ask you about it later, and we still can talk about it a little bit later, but I do have the new one targeted, and this is your
First nonfiction.
first nonfiction. So I've only gotten about a third of the way through it, but it's very fascinating. How was it different writing this than writing your fiction stuff?
Yeah, I mean, in fiction, if I make a mistake, even if it's history based, I don't think there's anything messed up history based in there yet, possibly, but I like to weave a lot of history into my novels anyway, and also on my social media and all the rest of it. But if I mess up on in a thriller, I can just say, hey, it's fiction.
Right.
Do that with this nonfiction, especially the way I wanted to do this, which was not to just read a bunch of books and then regurgitate them and then add my analysis to it. I wanted a serious work of fiction, going back to primary source material, looking into declassified documents, interviewing survivors, interviewing family members of the deceased, going through letters and photos that people in Beirut had sent home during that time frame, to really paint a picture of what was happening there on the ground, and then also paint a picture of what was going on at the executive level in the Oval Office, and who was advocating to put Marines ashore, who was advocating to keep them on ships in the Med, who was a staunch advocate of intervention, and what that was like. And that was really interesting because in Reagan's diary, got to read Reagan's diary. And so there's some things in the book that have never been published before from his diary, from that time frame. And you just get a sense of what a big heart he had. That really comes through. Like he and this affected him. I talked to Michael Reagan as well, and he said this haunted his father till the day he died. And when I say this, for those listening or watching, it's the 1983 Beirut and headquarters barracks bomb or bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, that killed 241 Marine or U.S. service members. So Marine, Navy personnel, and three Army. And it just was the largest Marine Corps loss of life in a single day since Iwo Jima in World War II. But I knew I wanted to write nonfiction at some point, and I just had to figure out when that point was. And when I thought I'd built up enough political capital with Simon and Schuster, then I pitched them this idea of doing a series that focuses on different terrorist events and looks into the strategic, operational, and tactical lessons learned, and then also humanizes the event. Because here are 241 people killed. That's a big number, but it doesn't humanize it. So I wanted to tell a story through the eyes of people who were there and really get out of the way of the story. Like my book, this is the stories of people who were there. It's theirs. And Simon and Schuster loved the idea. And I told them, hey, I want this to be a serious work of nonfiction. So I want to work with someone who knows what they're doing in this. And that's James Scott. And so I wanted to work with him. Loved his work. He has five other books out, four on World War II, one on the USS Liberty. And I just loved his work. I didn't know anything about him, but loved his work. And I was on the phone with my agent and publisher, and they said, okay, well, let's see if we can talk to him at least. Well, who's his agent? And I picked up his latest book and was going through the acknowledgments and the author's note, and it said he's thanking some guy named John Glusman here. And my publisher, Emily Bessler, was like, what? That's my husband. They both work in the same industry at
Oh,
different levels.
no way.
So they put us together and we hit it off, and now we're dear friends. So but he's a serious scholar, serious military historian, Pulitzer Prize finalist. So I got to learn so much about research and going into archives and attribution of different how to do that with people you interview and make sure that's all done appropriately and legally. And so I couldn't be more proud of how this came out. And then also it's just so humbling to write this book because people didn't make it home, and there's been an empty seat at dinner tables ever since 1983. And some guys that did make it home are still living with the physical and emotional trauma of that day. So it's an honor to have been trusted with their story, and humbling to get it out there.
For sure. Well, it's definitely good. I would check it out if you guys are listening. If you like, especially if you like military history, or also it talks to, gets into a lot of the themes of like how the Middle East got to where it is today, So super fascinating.
Parallels, a lot of parallels. But since we're talking about it, like the one huge parallel, one that gives me hope, because it was a dark day for the Marine Corps and one they wanted to move on from very quickly. And you really get a sense of that when you talk to these guys. I mean, it wasn't raising the flag on Iwo Jima. It was a dark day. But what gives me hope, even today, all these years later, is that the same U.S. service member that got blown off their feet, or that heard the explosion from another building, they got up and they ran to the sound of that explosion, just like at 8 in Afghanistan in August of 2021, that after that bomb went off, killed 13 service members there. Everyone else ran to the sound of that explosion. Some holding security, others trying to save as many people as they possibly can. So that's the same U.S. service member in both of them. And then, unfortunately, it's the same type of establishment that puts them in those tactically disadvantageous and essentially untenable positions. So it's the same establishment that puts them there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I want to dig into that a little bit later too, but real quick, just for people listening, I know that you've probably done it a million times, so I encourage people to go listen to maybe other podcasts where you dig deeper into your bio, but just give the listeners a quick bio just of your career and then also how hunting was has been a part of your life as well.
So knew I wanted to be SEAL from age 7 onward. Even before age 7, I knew I wanted to serve in uniform. And I think that's because my grandfather was killed in World War II. It's probably just in my blood anyway, but my grandfather was killed in World War II. So I grew up with the his pictures of him and his squadron. He was a Corsair pilot, Marine Corsair pilot, which is the
Oh.
plane gull wings that would fold up like that.
Okay. My grandfather was a ball turret gunner on a
Oh, dang.
B-24. Yeah.
Oh, wow. He made it.
He wished they were shot down. He was a POW for 2 years.
Whoa,
Yep.
that's wild. Has he told you stories, or did he tell you stories?
He told me some, but he died when I was pretty young and he didn't really like talking about it. So he gave me like the general story, but I just watched that series Masters of the Air. Have you seen that?
Yeah,
And
amazing.
it gave me like, I was like, a little kid hearing it in very little detail. Then I was watching, I was like, wow, this guy went through some crazy stuff probably. So, but he's passed away now. And then my other like grandfather was a helmsman on the USS Essex in the
Oh,
Pacific. So anyway, go ahead.
wow.
Didn't mean to
No kidding.
interrupt. Yeah.
You got some history there. That's amazing. And did you talk to him? Did he tell you stories, or did he make
Oh
it?
yeah. Yeah. We were very close and he survived a lot later. They got hit by a kamikaze at one point. He was there at Tarawa. Like he was through all of it. I think he said his foot didn't hit solid ground for like 2 or 3 years or something. He was on the ship.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. If you haven't read Winds of War and War and Remembrance by Herman Woke, those are it's historical fiction. So it tells the story of the lead up to World War II and takes you through World War II through the eyes of essentially one family, other points of view as well, but through a family that one has a captain, one's a pilot, one's on a submarine, one has a fiance that's trapped in Europe. It's amazing how much history you can learn by reading historical fiction
Yeah.
because it's written in a narrative type form that's approachable and
Yeah.
engaging. So I'd highly recommend anybody listening to read Herman Woke's Winds of War and War and
Okay.
Remembrance. They're fantastic. Don't get intimidated by the size either. You might just kind of get an audio so you don't like tell,
Yeah.
how long they are. But they're incredible. Put down the phone and get reading, I'd say. But yeah, so I just knew had my eyes on being a SEAL from the earliest of days. My family didn't hunt back then. It was but we spent a lot of time outdoors. We were like river rafting and backpacking and rock climbing, mountaineering and that sort of thing. So I got to grow up in a family that I was fortunate enough to do that to spend a lot of time outside. And then at home, I remember the back of Soldier of Fortune magazine. I'd order anything I possibly find on special operations, but there were a couple like Betamax tapes on SEALs that showed some of their training in obstacle courses, and then some footage from Vietnam and guys just rocking it with the Stoner 63, like just cutting down the jungle. And so I'd see some of that stuff and be like, oh, I should put a rope up in my this tree and climb that rope, or I should get on the top of the roof with my bow and shoot down into my target at an angle, and I should do some pull-ups, but it looks like these guys are doing this thing in the obstacle course, so I should probably, even though I have this like pull-up bar as part of some tree fort, I should like change my grip and do weird things. So I was doing that very early before there was any no one ever heard of the term functional fitness, I don't think, back then. I certainly hadn't. And there's sprinting the hills and those sorts of things, putting on an old rucksack, like an Alice rucksack that from the Army Navy store, and putting weight in it and then trying to run in it with boots and that sort of a thing. So I was
Wow.
doing anything I possibly could to stay in shape. And then any school sports I did, like lacrosse or soccer or cross country, whatever, I would
Yeah, I
always
played lacrosse too.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah. It's what a great sport. So I was thinking like, how's this gonna help me, you know, later type thing. I was always thinking about how this is gonna, you know, help build the foundation for what I'm gonna do later, to include reading and reading from a very early age. My mom was a librarian, so I grew up surrounded by books and a love of reading, and anything that had to do with warfare, I would devour. When I got to an age where I could read the same kind of books my parents were reading, which was certainly by sixth grade, that's when I decided that after my time in uniform that I'd be an author. And so I'm reading all the nonfiction I can find on warfare, terrorism, insurgencies, counterinsurgency, special operations, and then I'm reading all the thrillers of the day as well. Back then, when I didn't have anything else to do other than, you know, stay out of sight and out of mind kind of thing. So I got to read those books just for the magic in the pages at a time when I wasn't worried about a mortgage or a car payment or a job or a family or anything like that. So all of those books I read back then really helped build the foundation for both my time in the military as a leader and operator in the SEAL teams, and then also as an author today. Because it'd be different, I think, to go back today. Or let's say I started wanting to start writing at age 40 and then think, oh, what should I have been reading for the last 30 years? And then go back and read some of those kind of classics from the 80s. But time when I have all these other distractions, all these other responsibilities, and it'd be different reading about, let's say, 1985 today than it was as a kid during that time in the Cold War, Reagan in the office, Gorbachev out, like all of the things are a part of my world. And, you know, people are looking for payphones and looking for a quarter and, you know, that sort of a thing. Oh, you can't call this person off on this mission in this thriller. Well, now you text them or whatever. So you didn't have to think of, you know, it was just a different time. It was a pure reading experience. I wasn't reading it because I wanted to be an author. I was reading them because I loved the magic in those pages. So I think that's a little different. But yeah, went in the military, late 90s, went to BUDS SEAL training, got there in January 97, got to my first SEAL team October of 97, one deployment before September 11th, and then 2 weeks into my second deployment was September 11th. We were in Guam, and phones started ringing up and down the hallways, and people banging on doors. And we went down to the basement where we had a TV, and we all watched the Twin Towers fall. And we thought we were going to get out of there right away and head like right to Afghanistan the next day. It didn't happen quite like that. There was a lot of confusion and planning and all the rest of it. We eventually, a couple of weeks later, I think it was, went to the Middle East and took over shipboarding operations in the Gulf from Team 3, who were enforcing the UN embargo against Iraq. Those guys ended up going to Afghanistan. We did shipboarding operations, which was pretty interesting. It's the only time I spent any time on a ship or at sea in the Navy, which is I'm thankful for as well. Then got to Afghanistan fairly soon thereafter. And I was started enlisted, was a sniper, became an officer, and then right to Afghanistan from there. And then a couple Iraqs and Southern Philippines, and did a 20 and a wake up, I say, 20 years and a wake up. When I got back from my last Iraq deployment, I realized like, this is the last time I will tactically maneuver guys in the battlefield, which is why I came in. And really what's ahead is some admin jobs, some staff jobs, and maybe I'll circle back as a team commanding officer at some point. But really, you're not, it sounds impressive, but you're back in a tactical operations center. You're more of a manager leader than you are a tactical operational, you know. So you're not kicking the doors in anymore with the guys, nor do they want you out there because you've been in staff jobs for the last 6 years or whatever it might be. So very clear to me that it was time to get out. So I listened to that little voice, and it's time to get out, take care of my family. We have three kids and a middle child with severe special needs who needed me home. So it was time to move on. It was a good run, but it was very clear that it was time to get out. And started hunting at as I always wanted to hunt growing up, and my family just didn't. We shot and stuff like that, but didn't hunt. I always wanted to, but it just wasn't a part of our upbringing. And so really started hunting as part of sniper sustainment training for the SEAL teams in 2000. So it's been 24 years now. But I was so excited to get up there to this place, and I'll just say it's in Washington State. I don't think they advertise that they do anything with the military. But yeah, one of my first hunt up there with my 300 Win Mag that I was pretty dialed
Nice.
in on after sniper school, and then we did a few other sniper sustainment trips over the years with the
Okay.
military, a few
So
different.
they do use hunting as training.
Yeah, I think that was one of the first times. I think I was on the. I want to say second trip. I think first official trip. I think they did like a survey or something like that, where they take all the sniper cell cadre up there and kind of evaluate. And I think they had to do some proposal and, you know, get it approved and do all that stuff. So I think that took a little while, and that was the sniper cell doing that at the team while I was in a platoon. And then During, I think it was right at the beginning of that second platoon, I believe. But yeah, I went up there and oh man, I
Just
just loved
hunted deer.
it. Yeah,
That's awesome.
was just beautiful. Yeah, and such a wonderful experience. And so that was fantastic. And then really it was only sniper sustainment stuff because the focus was really for me on training and preparing for war. Busy in Iraq and Afghanistan. I didn't really take much leave or anything like that. Any leave I did take was like for family for Thanksgiving or Christmas if I wasn't deployed. And so I built up a lot of leave, which comes into the hunting later. So when I get back from this Iraq deployment, and my daughter just took an interest in hunting, and not I didn't push it on her or anything like that. We had Outdoor Channel going in the background a lot because it was during a time when we were like just concerned about the commercials on regular kids shows. Even they were just like, kids show, but then they show some crazy commercial on there and you're like, that what? But on the Outdoor Channel, you could trust, like, you're gonna have Jim Shockey coming on, to talk about Bass Pro Shops or something like that, and like pretty safe, those commercials. So we had Outdoor Channel running. We knew a few people that had shows and stuff like that. So just from going to the SHOT Show and stuff, I was always going to SHOT Show in Vegas, just because the private sector was usually even a little bit ahead of the military when it came to different things like, let's say, layering systems or different even like body armor or carriers or whatever. So I would always go to that from the earliest of times back when. For those listening who have been there, it was almost no tactical stuff. It was like a
Oh,
room
wow.
inside a library that was the tactical side. Even right
Now
after,
it's like a
oh,
three football fields of tactical stuff.
football tactical. Yeah, it's changed, and that was like 2003, 2004. I don't think it quite had caught the tactical stuff hadn't caught on yet, and then boom, like 2005, 6, it just like exploded and has only continued to grow. The front, it seems anyway. So I was always going there, so that's why I got to know some people in the hunting space and that sort of a thing. But so I was always there, and it wasn't intentional that I would develop relationships with people there. I was just there to check out all the gear and all that stuff. And then the byproduct of being there and being sincerely interested in gear and advances in technology and all the rest of it is you just develop relationships with people naturally. That's been fantastic too, even as an author, going back to SHOT Show and signing books with some of these companies that I've got to know back in 2003, 2004 time frame. So it's really, so I have 20 years of a personal relationship with a lot of them, which is pretty cool. But my daughter took an interest in hunting, and luckily we had some friends with property, and so we went out to Red River County in Texas on the Texas-Oklahoma border. So no fences and stuff in that kind of type of part of Texas, and really it's just started taking her hunting. And took her out there, took her to another place in Texas with another friend, and she got her first elk at age 10 in New Mexico.
Oh, cool.
Took the family to Africa because I'd been over there doing some. This is after I got out. Went over there to do some research for First True Believer and Savage Son. So I went to Mozambique for True Believer to do some boots on the ground research for that book,
Cool.
and I went back, not to Mozambique, but I went to South Africa to help train up an anti-poaching unit. And what I learned there, some of it made it into a True Believer and some of it made it into Savage Son. It was at that time frame right
That's
before
cool.
were published.
Like
So
Reese does.
yeah, exactly. So I got to do that and learn a ton. They were switching over to some M4s and Glocks, this anti-poaching unit. So I had some experience on those systems, and so went over there with a Marine buddy, and we had an incredible experience together. And then they invited me back and to bring my family the next summer.
That's
So
awesome.
took the family back, and we had an incredible experience out there. I had these photos of the kids when they're young, and just hunting out there, just in the back of the Land Cruiser, hair in the breeze, blood on their, put on their cheek off, and it was just my son's handprint next to a lion paw in the kind of the sand and dirt. So yeah, hunting's been a part of my life for a while there. We were only eating wild game for years. Now enough people that I know have ranches and stuff, and so they send me boxes like beef and things like that. But for a while there, it was just wild game. We just ate everything that we got from moose, elk, deer, and just it
That's
filled
awesome, man.
the freezers and all that. So our little house in Coronado, California, which is where the West Coast SEAL teams are, it's like a beach bungalow, and it was just filled with taxidermy. People would come over like, what the? And I'd have these wild game dinners and stuff like that over there. So now try to get out there as much as I can, but I just had to turn down a hunt at Deseret here just down the road.
Oh no.
Actually,
You
I should be
can't
there
turn
right
down
now.
a Deseret hunt, bro.
Yeah, I should be right today. Yep, I'd be there right now.
Tell them I'll go.
Hey, I'd be there right now with Rogan right now. But
Oh
it's
man.
yeah, but that's just how it goes. You know, there's
So
a lot
you
of people.
turned down Rogan and Deseret to be on my podcast, basically.
Hey, I heard yours came up, and I'm like, oh, gotta say no. Yep.
Hey guys, I want to talk to you really quick about one of my favorite partners, which is blackovis.com. And I've been using Black Ovis since way before I had a TV show or a podcast or any of that stuff. They're kind of your one-stop shop for anything you need as far as solid hunting gear. They got camping stuff, they got crispy boots, seek outside shelters, loophole optics, tons of other great brands. And they also have their own in-house brand, which is pretty good stuff. They got some really good merinos and some puffies that I've worn before. And they're at a great price point. The other thing I love about Black Ovis is their custom arrow shop. A lot of people don't know this, but you can send in your exact specifications for your specific type of arrow, your length, your fletchings, your inserts, field tips, all that stuff. And Black Ovis will custom make your arrows and send them straight to your door. It's a really cool deal, guys. So go over there to blackovis.com, check out everything they got over there. And when you do, use the promo code QUEST and you will save and you'll help support the show. So go to blackovis.com, use that code QUEST and get some solid hunting gear. Just
Yeah.
kidding. But thanks, man. No, that's really cool. And I'm always fascinated because it's not my story, but by guys like you. And I had a podcast with Jim Shockey. He was kind of similar that like you guys knew exactly what you want to do at a young age and you're just like laser focused, went for it. And then did you grow up on the East Coast?
Northern California. Just
Okay. I was
yeah.
wondering about the lacrosse thing. So I grew up in Virginia Beach,
Oh, no
interestingly.
way. Yeah. Right
And
there.
so yeah, right there, man. Like, and then now I live in Fairfax County, Virginia. So I'm
Oh,
like, all the stuff you're talking about, your books. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm right there, right
no
there.
kidding. Oh, how do you end up the, what do you do up there besides this?
I'm full-time TV producer of The Hunting Show and podcaster on YouTube.
Nice, from Fairfax. Okay.
I was working for about 7 years for the Christian Broadcasting Network, doing humanitarian and disaster relief
Oh.
stories. They're based in Virginia Beach.
Okay.
And then I kind of, long story short, moved into the hunting space and kind of applied that TV knowledge and stuff to this. So,
Oh, wow.
yeah,
Awesome.
man. And then I gotta ask because I was listening, I love when you drop like cool brands into your novels.
Yeah.
And the other day, I finally heard you drop Amtac. So Bill
Yeah.
Rapier, he was a volunteer in my youth group when I was a kid, and like I took him on a hunting trip when I got older. Like, we've been friends for years, and I love that dude. You know him?
Yeah, I don't know him well, but I know him, enough to want to put his blades in my books, and
Okay.
I think I have every one of them. I point out there because there's a whole table full of blades out there. So yeah, he's in at least three of the novels.
Oh, is
Yeah,
he? Okay.
everything has to be woven in, naturally. So it's people that don't know these different spaces, they some people are cynical and just like think I get paid to put that stuff in there, but that no, it's no one has ever paid
You
for
just
anything.
work in like brands you like and stuff.
Yeah, like as for me, it tells me something about that person. If the person's carrying an Amtec blade in their appendix, or maybe it's the Amtec blade clipped in their pocket, and then they're carrying a Striker Fire pistol and Kydex holster and appendix, and they're wearing something like a nylon belt and Salomon boots or whatever. That tells me something about their creation and how they've trained and who they trained with. They're carrying an Amtec blade. I think they've trained with Bill Rapier, so they know this is kind of what they're into. Some
Bill's the
other.
guy that convinced me to get my concealed carry permit
Oh, nice.
when I was
Yeah,
like
of course.
21 or whatever.
Nice. Yeah,
Yeah,
we
man.
sat in, and I think I get that from it's very natural. It'd be very unnatural for me to just say like, he pulled a knife from his waistband or something like that. Like I just have to know. That tells me so much about somebody, what they carry, how they carry it. It tells me so much about their background that it's just, it'd be unnatural for me not to weave that stuff in. But it's all about character development and has to be natural. And if I can help out a buddy in the in as I'm going, then so be it. Yeah. But I think I got that from Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming was one of the first people to do that in the Bond novels, to talk about the Bond liked his coffee or his breakfast or what watch he wore, what pistol he used, that sort of a thing. So he was really one of the first to do that. And I think that wore off at an early age. And I'm just a gear guy anyway, so it'd be weird for me not to incorporate specific gear into my.
No, I love it because I always like look up what you say, and then a lot of your characters too are like very, I like it because they're like connoisseurs, like they have like the nice, they know the nice watches or the nice firearms or even like whiskey or cigars or whatever. You know what I mean? Like it's
Yeah.
kind of that manly, most interesting man in the world kind of thing. Like just being simple, but having like a depth of knowledge and kind of a connoisseur of stuff like that. It's kind of cool to me.
Yeah, no, I love doing that. It differentiates characters. Some guy's a Scotch drinker or something like that from, let's say, Africa. Another person is a wine connoisseur from Montana, or somebody else is, old school, like they build rifles or use a 1911 only type thing. And so there's, I love different vehicles. Someone drives a Land Cruiser like me and like my character. And then somebody else is in a Defender. So I have to have them making fun of each other and talking about Defender breaking down and that sort of a thing.
I love it, man. And it sounds like, going back to what I was saying earlier, because I was going to ask about your transition to civilian life, but it sounds like you had a pretty clear focus on what you wanted to do. And then also maybe hunting probably could have been there to kind of play a role in kind of that transition too, huh?
Yeah, I started really taking some leave when I got back from that last Iraq deployment and taking my daughter hunting. And then I'd go on a, have gone, gone on a few. I really like to take the kids as much as I can. So I might just go on because they can't for whatever reason. We had one down to Argentina, actually. I was doing research for Only the Dead or Red Sky Morning for Only the Dead. So second to the last thriller. This one place was, it was going to take place in Argentina. In my outline, it was in Argentina, and I was ready to. I went down there to do research, and I was gonna bring the whole family with me. And we got closer, and my daughter was in high school then, and she's like, "Dad, I have like I don't know finals or whatever it was." And I was like, "Oh, geez, okay." And then our middle child had to have some medical stuff go on, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I should just cancel this whole trip." But I already committed with someone else, and so my wife was out, my daughter was out, our middle son can't go, regardless. And then our youngest one, I'm like, "All right, you and me, buddy." And we pulled the passport out, and it was like gonna expire in like 2 months. In that window, you have to have like 3 or 6 months or whatever it is, some places. And so I was like, ah, geez. But that was 100% going to be Argentina. And then for people who have read the book, it's the Colorado sections where originally supposed to be Argentina. But then it just, when I got there in the narrative, then it just didn't make sense. It felt forced to get it there. It was much more natural to keep it in Colorado, just geographically for how things were laying out. So I'll get Argentina back in there at some point though.
I've always wanted to go down there too, man. Okay. I want to dig into some of the themes from your books real quick. The first thing that I want to talk to you about is like, when I looked at it from the surface, I felt like it was kind of a duality of like, sort of a cynical view of like America and the leadership and the government. Everything. I mean, it's pretty obvious in Terminalist, but it's more subtle in other books too. And then also this fierce loyalty and willing to die for it on the other side. And I know that's something that Reese struggles with probably in some of the books too. But I'd love to hear you just kind of talk on it a little bit too, because I went through a period where I was really struggling, kind of learning more about government and just sort of the a lot of the deception and corruption and crap. And that I really had the realization of like America is great because of the people, not because of like the swamp. You know what I mean? Like,
In
and
spite of
so,
the swamp, yeah, or in
and so
spite.
like it's almost like James Reese is kind of like your everyday Joe, even though he's like crazy awesome warrior, he's also like sort of your everyday hero, right? And then you have your kind of seedy guys at the top. But I had that revelation where it's like you can love America for the American people. You know, we the people, not the gut, because like you get disillusioned quickly is all I'm trying to say with the leadership. So anyway, I'd love to hear you talk on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, our elected representatives work for us. They're our employees, and somehow we've flipped that around over the years, and somehow they continue to take power and keep us, in this psychologically anyway. People think that they're somehow ruling over us for whatever reason. They're our employees. They work for us. We should fire most of them. But yeah, I try not to be too cynical. In day, it's hard, as you with experience and I guess age, maybe a little bit creeps in, but I try not to be too cynical. But I also can apply that to characters in the novels, which is very therapeutic. And then I'm allowed to remove players from the board in a way you couldn't do it in real life because you go to jail forever. But you can do it in the pages of a thriller. And for me, it's very therapeutic. And unfortunately, elected representatives, the established bureaucracy who essentially cannot be fired. You'd have to work very hard to be fired in this permanent Washington culture, in this ecosystem, and our senior military leaders, give me a lot to work with when it comes to ineptitude or foreign policy mistakes, lessons, and some just blatant criminal activity, whether it's and some that's not criminal but legal but immoral and unethical when it
Yeah.
comes to lobbying and some of these other things and jobs that you take after your time in uniform and all of that. So I get to explore all that in the pages of the novels, and it's very naturally woven in. Unfortunately, I don't have to work too hard on some of these things to create some of these bad guys because they're out there, and a lot of them are on the news every night. So I can there's a deep well, I guess,
Yeah.
from which to draw, and I love doing it. I love writing stories. Like I said, I've read all those guys growing up. They were the masters in the art of storytelling. I'm reading Tom Clancy and Nelson DeMille, who unfortunately passed away yesterday. David Morrell, AJ Quinnell, J.C. Pollock, Mark Olden, Louis L'Amour, all these guys that I read growing up that were my professors in the art of storytelling. So I had this very solid foundation and a very deep understanding of the history of the genre because I was reading those guys, which were my contemporary, essentially, written in contemporary times when I was reading them. And then also reading the stuff that was on my parents' shelves, like John le Carré and Ludlum and Ian Fleming and Ken Follett and authors like that. So I got to read all of that to build this foundation. So I knew I'd given myself this education throughout my life. So there's a lot to work with out there when I do this, but I try not to be too cynical, but I try to also put myself in the enemy's shoes when it comes to developing those types of characters and really look at whatever the situation is through the enemy's eyes. That's what I did downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's what you have to do down there. You have to anticipate what the enemy's going to do next. You have to figure out how they would adapt to you if you had their experience and knowledge base and were in their shoes anticipating your moves. So you have to try to get ahead of it, get inside their decision-making process, figure out how to capitalize on your own momentum, figure out how to identify gaps in the enemy's defenses, and then how to exploit those. So I do that in the pages of the novels as well, from different people's perspective and different characters' perspective, different countries' perspective, that sort of a thing. So there's a lot to work with out there. I don't think I'll ever
Yeah.
be, I'll ever have to think of what should I write next. There's a lot out there to explore.
Are you optimistic about America? Is there hope for us?
I try to be optimistic and I want to be hopeful. I try to look for the silver lining personally in things always. But then when it comes to the country, I try. I'm doing my best. And I like when on my podcast, I try to ask people also, like, what gives you hope? I try to ask them that question because I'm always not looking for hope, like personally, but as a country, when you see just how big these bureaucracies have become and how much power they have and where we are as a country and how the citizenry is, for generally speaking, not as informed as perhaps it once was because of all these distractions through companies that gain power and influence and are financially motivated to keep us addicted to devices that are with us every single second, essentially, to say nothing of platforms on those devices that are bad enough for adults. Imagine what they're doing to our children. So I try to remain, in spite of all of this, and those same devices and platforms also manipulating thoughts and behaviors, not just purchasing practices like maybe a commercial in the 80s or 90s, but really influencing thoughts and behaviors and their manipulation devices and listening devices that are with us 24/7, essentially. I heard someone talking the other day. I think it popped up in my horrible say, hopped to my Instagram feed. A guy was saying, he's like, think of how we grew up and running around the woods and talking to friends and building jumps for your bike and doing all that stuff, trying to get home before it got too dark and all that. And he said, then take 80% of that away and replace it with screen time. That's what's happening. I was like,
It's wild.
I told my wife that. I'm like, oh, Gosh.
It's
So
depressing. It's depressing,
it is.
man.
So I try to remain hopeful.
Yeah.
We're up against some pretty powerful forces, but I think the first step is just realizing that these things that we carry around with us are manipulation devices, manipulating us and our children. So if you recognize that, then perhaps you can take some steps. So I would not be on any of these things if I didn't have, it wasn't my, essentially my storefront. I looked at it as, because I was never on social media before I got out of the military, before I had the books. But I knew that in today's day and age, I can't do what was so appealing about being an author back in, let's say, 1987, when I thought, oh my gosh, I can live in a cabin in the mountains. I can write these books. I can send them to New York, maybe do one interview and then go back to writing. Very introverted by nature. I would love to just be in a cabin in the woods all the time, or in a hammock outside in the, tied between two trees and reading. And then I realized probably a month or two before the first book came out that that's not how it is anymore. And unless you're an
Nope.
outlier, unless you developed your readership in some cases in the 70s, like Stephen King or Ken Follett, but 80s, 90s, unless you built this readership up then under that kind of legacy model, you're gonna have to do something else. Unless you're an outlier, unless you're a Twilight or a 50 Shades of Grey, and there's outliers in every industry and profession. But if you're not one of those, then in order to build up that readership in this age when there are so many distractions that you're competing with, not just the devices and the platforms I just talked about, but you can go to a TV and watch any movie at any time and any TV show at any time that has ever been created. Whereas back in the 80s or 90s, you had to wait for your favorite show to come on at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. Or you had to beg your parents to let you stay up for 10 p.m. to watch Miami Vice or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Or if you wanted to watch a movie, you couldn't just be like, I'm gonna watch a movie, click. I had to wait for it to come out. It's
Or
coming
go
out.
rent it or
I
something.
want to be there at 7:30 on Friday night and want my mom to take me or
Yeah.
whatever it was. But now it's instant gratification available any second, anytime. So you're
Yeah.
competing with all of that. You're not competing with other authors. You're competing with everything
Everything.
out there. That it's not just entertainment, but our everything else on our phones as well, news and everything else there that's meant to distract us and limit our time on each one or each subject, so we don't deep think deeply about it, because that's dangerous and for a populace.
So they're
For,
trying to keep us a mile wide and inch deep.
I
That's
think
the
the
goal.
it's it, and it's financially lucrative to some, and then to others, obviously, it increases that power because you're manipulating thoughts and behaviors through what's being fed. It's yeah, it's sad. It's rough.
Yeah.
But any point being, I would not have these things if
Yeah.
I storefront. So when I realized I needed them, I thought, well, it'll be like my general store. Meaning, if someone walks into my general store in small town USA and they come in and they want to buy like six pack of Coors or something, I'm like, okay, it's over there in the corner in the refrigerator, from behind the counter. Awesome. Or if they come in and want directions out of town, I give them that too, even if they don't buy anything. So I kind of
Yeah.
looked at social media is that, and a way for me to thank people. But unfortunately, in wanting to thank people who reach out and say, love the book or love the show or whatever else, right? Just order your last one or pre-order targeted. I still see all the nasty stuff, which takes up bandwidth. So I need to figure out how to deal a little bit better with that from a
Yeah.
management perspective. But we're
It's a
dealing.
necessary evil, man, you know? Especially
Oh,
like in
we could do this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a necessary evil. I'm in my space trying to resist the push to making every single video 20 seconds long. Like I'm trying to stay long form and but yeah, you have to be in and I've looked at publishing a little bit too, but you have to be everything all the time everywhere to do anything these days. And so it is tough. I remember trying to explain to my kid the other day like what live TV was and like how you had to like wait for a show at a time. He was like, "What?" Like he didn't even get it.
Oh, geez, brutal, brutal.
But like I don't know. Without going too crazy deep into it, I mean, I guess the only thing we can really do is just do our best as individuals and as family units to live how we would like to see the world and just try our best and pray and just do
Yeah.
your best, I guess.
Yeah, you have to adapt to an ever-changing environment, and in a way that's appropriate to you and your family and your core belief systems. And I think that's probably the best we can do these
Yeah.
days.
But some people, I mean, some people legitimately like that may be listening might need a wake up call, like get off your butt, like get in shape, be a man, like live as a provider, as a protector.
That's why
Like
hunting's
we need to do better.
Yeah, that's why hunting is so great, because when we go on hunting trips, typically with the family, you're going to a place where you don't have Wi-Fi, you don't have cell service. So it forces you off, me included, forces you off these devices, forces the kids off. I like to do a river rafting trip every year, get in the bottom of a canyon where you don't have Wi-Fi or cell service. And it forces you to be together and to be off these devices. But it's for me as well. You know, I hate that the kids might have a vision of me like on a phone. You know, I so I try to put the phones up here and away from the down, not downstairs, which yeah, but it's tough. Everybody expects you to be there all the time, and text doesn't come back for an hour because I was downstairs with the family. You know, it's just a just how, but hey, that's just how it goes. Gotta figure it out. We're all navigating it, I think, and it's such a huge change, and things are evolving so fast that it makes adaptability adapting to these changing environments, especially when it comes to family and kids, very difficult, especially when you have such powerful forces that are allied against you.
For sure. On that note, let me grab my cell phone here really quick.
Ha.
Because I've been using my phone to listen to your novels. There's one section in the beginning of Savage Son that I wanted to like just dive into real quick. We don't have a ton of time, but just maybe talk on it really quick because I think it's interesting. This tie between hunting and fighting, hunting and war, and like the position of that in our lives as men, I guess. But here, let me just play this. It's like a minute and a half long section.
Hunting and war are inexorably mixed. They share a common father. Death begets life, and in defense of one's self, one's family, one's tribe, or one's country, killing is often a part of the equation. Throughout most of human history, defeating an enemy in battle led to the survival of the tribe and the continuation of the bloodline. The same tools developed to defeat rivals in combat are analogous to those used in the quest for sustenance. Similar tactics are used to hunt both man and beast. Those who picked up a spear to defend the tribe were the same ones who used that spear to provide food for their families. The reason each and every one of us is alive today is the martial prowess and hunting abilities of our ancestors. Much as the hunter deep in the back country often thinks of his family by the hearth, so too the warrior on the distant battlefield longs for a homecoming. Similarly, when they return home, the hunter dreams of going back to the woods, just as the warrior yearns for battle. Is it the guilt of no longer being in the fight? Not standing shoulder to shoulder with brothers in arms? Or is it missing the sense of belonging that only comes from being part of a team that has spilt blood in war? Or is it something darker? Is it because of the kill? Is it because that is the only place one can truly feel alive?
Wow, that whole
Yeah.
preface is a bomb. But
Thank you. Yeah, people reach out all the time about not just that one, but all of them. So it's kind of become a thing for all the books. I like to put a lot of,
yeah.
well, my heart and soul goes into every word that I write in the stories. But that one is, that's not, the preface isn't a story. It's setting the tone for what's to come. And so that's all
Yeah.
obviously from me. Whereas in the story, there might be a position of a character that's, you know, not me, obviously, because it's a different, you know, character. I have a Chinese intelligence officer that's the Chinese intelligence officer. That preface is, I enjoy writing them. It's very therapeutic to write them, and people seem to really enjoy them. And it's a little different than any other author does out there.
Yeah. And I realized that the reason I've never really admitted this out loud, I think, but the reason I think that resonates so much with me is because I always wanted to be in the military when I was a kid. And whatever reason I didn't go that way. Well, I know mainly because I went off the wrong path. Like I got into drugs and partying and the music. I was in a band and blah, 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 blah. Which I've been very public about all that. But basically, I was just not the person that I was meant to be when I was kind of at that age, I guess, military age or whatever, quote unquote. And so I never went that path. And I feel like a lot of the reason that I do what I do and why I'm so drawn to hunting, is in the style of hunting I do, backcountry mountain hunting, is because I'm like, I don't know. I can't think of a better word besides like repressed warrior.
Yeah.
So
I went
it's this
that.
weird kind of feeling of guilt, honestly, or like it's kind of maybe one of the only things I regret really in my life. But now I don't know. Hunting is, I guess, helping with that. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, you're out there providing, and you have the skills to pick up that rifle in defense of home, just like people have from the beginning of time up to today. But the draw, like why you wanted to join the military, it's such a natural thing, because for thousands and thousands of years, you had to do something that would prove your value to the tribe. A crucible that young men in particular had to do, let's say between the ages of, like, let's say 12 and 20, somewhere in there, it moves around. But there was something that was put in place in most societies that would allow you to then that join that company of men who were the hunters and who were the providers and who were the warriors of
Being
that tribe.
part of something greater than yourself, right?
And being like, oh, I think I'm going to join these guys, or hey, I'm 15 now, it's time to. No, you had to prove yourself, and so I think that's still in us. That's a very natural thing, and typically the draw is like Marine Corps boot camp. That's the one that you probably is probably the biggest draw for those that really listen to that call. But really, it's any boot camp, or it's any special operations type training, like BUDS for SEALs or Q Course for Army Special Forces or Army Rangers for Ranger School. But it's in there. I think it's in most all. I think it's in all of us. It's just been repressed over time, because now we are surrounded by comforts and distractions. But it's there for those who listen. So I think that's probably what that is. And then if you don't do it, then there might be that little piece that feels like you missed something. But you can't go back, obviously, but you can do other things. And hunt is the same thing as providing for that tribe, for that family, picking up that weapon in order to provide food for the table, and not just yours, but others. So there's so many similarities, even in the tactics, like I mentioned in that preface, like building a pattern of life. If you let's say for people who use trail cameras or something, then that what time this herd has been in this valley, whatever it might be. But it's a pattern of life, and that's the same thing you're developing when you're hunting a person downrange, is you're developing that pattern of life, and then you're waiting to do that, and then you're corroborating that through disassociated human sources and some technical intelligence perhaps, and you're building out that picture, and then you're waiting for a trigger that lets you know, that confirms that yes, he's on this path, this pattern of life that we've developed at this house, at this time, at this meet, cafe, whatever it is. But it's the same thing you're doing when you're in a pattern wildlife. So it's or it's just scanning a hillside. I mean, it's the same thing you're doing as a sniper. You're aware, and you're scanning, and you're looking, and you're looking at your 5 meter targets, and then their immediate threats, and then those that are farther off. So there's so many similarities between hunting and warfare, or hunting animals and people. It's pretty remarkable.
It is remarkable when you really start to dig into it. And I guess too, part of my mission as a man now is to protect my family. So I guess just making sure I'm living in a way that I'm ready for the worst case scenario, I guess is part of my mission now.
Yeah, it's a very natural thing for especially a man. It's our responsibility to protect that family,
Yes.
protect our spouse, our kids, provide for them. Speaking of, what's that rifle behind you?
That is a Weatherby Range XP with a and 300 Win Mag with an MDT Alpine chassis on it. Leupold VX6 HD 4-24.
Nice. And what is it on right there? What's that tripod?
That's a Manfrotto. That's kind of more of a prototype, but Manfrotto just released a they're a big name in the film and TV kind of space. They just released a hunting specific tripod called the Alpha Shot tripod, which I've
Okay.
been working with them some on product development stuff too. So that is one of the that's one of them.
Oh,
So
nice. I have a lot of those tripods, but they're not. But they're the like the film and photo ones for like podcasts and all the rest of it. But I didn't know they had a hunting specific one. I'm gonna look that up. And I might
They
have one.
just started.
Did they have one? But they had one for spotting scopes before. I think I'd have one for a Swarovski. Is that possible?
I mean, I think any tripod would probably work great with the with
Yeah.
spotting scope stuff, but like this is their first product line, specifically hunting and PRS and law enforcement
Okay.
tactical and stuff. Actually, they flew me out to their facility in Italy. I was already in Spain on a hunt, and they flew me to Italy to meet the team, and I like talked to them about the product and like
Oh, awesome.
what mountain. Like somehow I'm the only American hunting consultant they have, and so I don't. That was just a God thing, but. They brought me in and I was kind of explaining to them like what I would need in a mountain hunting tripod and like how they could improve it and stuff. But I'm really stoked that they're kind of doing something in the space. So.
Nice. I'm gonna have to check that out for sure. I haven't been to Spain to hunt yet. I really want to do that. I want to get over to Europe, and because each country in Europe seems to have different hunting traditions, and
For sure.
I'd love to just dive into that. I haven't really done that yet, so it's on.
Spain's a cool one.
And not as expensive, I think, as some other ones from what I've heard anyway. You can probably find whatever you want, I guess, but
Yeah, I had a friend, Pedro Ampuero. He invited me. He's Spanish, and he invited me over there. If you need a contact, actually, I'll link you up with him. He's probably one of the best bow hunters alive right now. Like, he has like multiple records. Look him up, Pedro Ampuero. Spanish dude. So yeah, I can link you up with him if you want. He'd be a great resource.
yeah, I need to get over there at some point. Probably in, the years get booked out pretty far in advance now, which is crazy.
I know, man.
Working on filling some gaps so I can have a little more time to take the family hunting. So
For sure, man.
that's one of the goals coming for the next couple of years here.
Yeah. Man, that makes me want to ask you nerd gun nerd questions, but it's okay. Another time.
I like the M3. How about that? I like the M300. That's all. That's
Yeah.
all.
Well, the gun, we don't have to go into it, but I just got a new Weatherby 300 PRC and it's 1 to 10 twist. But my Barnes Vortex, I just looked up, they don't recommend anything less than a 1 to 8 twist.
Interesting. Interesting. Oh my God.
So,
I got a 300 PRC for the first time. I really want to take it out to and run it. I haven't yet, but I have two. Now I have two of them now out there, but I haven't used them. I've been too busy. But
yeah.
great. Seems like a great round.
We'll see. I haven't tried it out yet. But okay, last question. We only got like a couple more minutes left. I want to be respectful of your time, but I just had to ask. Like, I know you weave in spirituality to a lot of your characters. I feel like James Reese is sort of searching for his faith. Maybe, I don't know. I see some Bible verses in the new book and stuff. Is faith part of your life?
Yeah, not in a way that I'm too public about, but I certainly weave it into the novels more so in this last one in Red Sky Morning for a variety of reasons. One being that it was just very natural as part of
Yeah.
this path and progression for the character. So yeah, I think I'm always trying to improve myself and be better at that side of life. I guess that's a good way to put it.
It's just like fitness, you can develop it, just like anything else. But, I was just like thinking, like, how do you, because like even sometimes when I'm like listening to your novels and stuff, it's kind of scary, some of the stuff you talk about, and like you know all this stuff like firsthand, and like you've researched a ton. Like, how do you like keep your head with all this scary stuff out there that could happen?
I don't know. I've always been, I don't think I've really changed my whole life. I have friends from kindergarten and first grade still that say, "Hey, you're the exact same, kid you were on the playground," type of a thing. So I had someone tell me that yesterday, or 2 days ago, that I was the same as I was when that person had met me like a decade ago. So yeah, I mean, I don't really think about it in those terms,
Yeah.
tell the best story I possibly can and weave in my experience. I want to continue learning along the way to make each book better than the last. Goals, like I said, is to always make it better than the last one, always to improve no matter what I'm doing in life. In the SEAL teams, it was I want to be a better leader and operator today than I was yesterday. And same thing, hope to be better than the current one. That's always going to be a better husband and father today than I was yesterday. So it's always about improvement for me. And so it's just these are just stories, and I don't
Yeah.
dwell on any of the negative parts of them, or the scary parts of them, or the violent parts of them. I mean, violence is part of human nature, has been from the beginning of time. It's just very natural for me to write about these things in an authentic way, or bring the feelings and emotions behind different experiences that I had in Iraq and Afghanistan or something like that, and then apply them to a completely fictional narrative. So even though the narrative is fiction, the feelings and emotions are coming from a real place. So therefore it feels real and visceral to the reader or the listener. So it's all about constant improvement.
Sounds good. Just kind of focus on yourself, get better every day, focus on yourself and your family, and just keep going. Just keep moving
That's it.
forward.
That's it. Keep moving forward.
Cool, man. Well, yeah, anything new you want to talk about coming out soon, or tell people where they can like grab some of your books or that kind of thing?
app. You can go to officialjackhar.com, and that's kind of the link to everywhere. But all the info is there. There's the podcast. There should be some news dropping very soon about the next thriller for next spring, and then
Sweet.
other news about the prequel origin story series that we're filming with Amazon with Chris Pratt and Taylor Kitsch,
Nice.
and then some news about the next book, True Believer, that we should start filming sometime in 2025. So lots of
Awesome.
news and projects on the horizon.
Yeah, man, that sounds awesome. If you're ever out in DC or anything, look me up. I'd love to take you out to
Awesome,
lunch or
man.
something.
It'd be
All
fantastic. It'd be
right,
fantastic.
man. Yeah,
Thumbs
thank
down.
you so much for your time.
Hey, no, I appreciate you having me on, and you take care.
You too, man. Have a good one.